Greetings and salutations. My name is Tyler Elenick, and this is Raven Drool, the podcast that chronicles all things 90s can rock. This episode is part one of a chat I had with Christian Simpson, the drummer of Toronto, Ontario's Glue Leg. You joined Glue Leg in and around 92, 93. I'm curious, what were you up to before that?
I'd been in many bands before that. Again, I was quite a bit older than, it was Carlos and Ruben at the time. Mm. And so I had done the Northern Ontario circuit, you know, playing in various cover bands, a few original projects I was in the past, but I was actually in a Supertramp tribute band. Nice. When I ended up joining Glue Leg, you know, but I was sort of looking for something original. I wanted to be part of an original project, but again, it had to be the right project. I wasn't just looking to get together with some guys and, you know, jam out some tunes. I was looking for a musical vision, something that I felt I could, you know, contribute to. In, you know, I think I was, my drumming style was a little different than most, and I wanted to kind of find somebody that I could actually even push that a little further. And so I saw an ad in Now magazine, and it was a band looking for a drummer, and they listed some references, and I know Rush was one of the references. I think Jane's Addiction and maybe King Crimson. And so right there I was like, yeah, I'm going to call these guys and just see what's up. So I did, I responded to the ad, and, you know, they're like, yeah, you know, come on down. So I went over to, I think it was Carlos's place, you know, they had a kit set up in the basement, and it was like, so what do you guys want to play? And one of them said, yeah, we're thinking of doing this King Crimson, a cover of their song Red. Huh. And I was like, yeah, this is the right thing. This is what I was looking for, right? I was like, yeah, I know that song. You know, we kind of roughed it out. And right then and there, I knew that this was the right project. So, that's what's, again, just an ad in the paper. And, you know, went down and checked it out. And it was sort of immediate. You know, again, they were younger guys. They're pretty raw. They could play, I could tell it was in a creative environment. And these guys wanted to kind of take something to, not play the kind of, necessarily what was kind of a popular at the time, the Pearl Jams, the Nirvanas. We wanted to do something a little different, and we did.
And so once you join, I mean, once you're, I guess, accepted, they just say, okay, you're in the band now. I mean, how does that conversation exactly happen?
Well, I mean, I think they were looking for a competent drummer that had some chops again, I've been playing, for a long time, and I was, playing with some pretty good musicians before Glue Leg, so I have my shit together as far as just, being able to play. So I think they were, when I sat down and started playing, they're like, oh yeah, fuck, this is the guy. I mean, what else are we looking for? It was pretty immediate. I thought, yeah, this is something I'd like to, continue with. And I think they're like, yeah, man, you're it. Let's do it. I don't really remember there being, hey, we'll give you a call. And, I sat by the phone waiting. It seemed to be pretty immediate.
Excellent. So once you are part of the group now, I mean, they did something before you joined the band called Angst, kind of kind of a full length. Now, do they present that to you and say, this is what we've already kind of done and want to take this further?
Yeah. They. That was part of the whole process too. The first sit down with Jam, and but it was also, they played me the cassette, the Angst cassette, and there were a couple of songs on that really leapt out. The song called Fraz was one. It's just so long ago, man. I'm just right now. I'm trying to go over the the track listing for Angst, I don't really know it, but I know a few songs and certainly a bunch of ideas from Angst ended up on, what was it, Park Alien. Yeah, a bunch of stuff ended up on Park Alien, which was a 4-song EP. And so we, you know, Angst was cannibalized a little bit, and we redid some of the stuff. But from listening to that cassette and playing with them, you know, I thought, yeah, there's some great ideas here. And I like the voices and everything that was going on. You know, was it just a cool? I had to kind of think about it, you know, like, oh, this, what's that going on? Oh, there's a lot of time in there. And so it wasn't your typical, run of the mill kind of rock and roll.
Indeed. Yeah. You mentioned early on, it was just Carlos and Ruben, who you were kind of jamming with. At what point does Bob and mm-hmm. Andrew get involved?
Okay. So we were getting ready for Park Alien. We were writing and recording. And there was a song on there, Galactic Cattle Hand. And I think we also put horns on another song called Cultural Faux Pas. Mm. So now the horn player came up because, again, I was playing in, you know, this Supertramp tribute band. And we had a horn player. Mm. And I said, well, I know a guy that, you know, can come in and he could, you know, he's a really good player. And he could come in and he could lay down some parts. So that's Andy. Mm. So Andy came over. And, but we wanted a, he was a sax player, but we wanted a trumpet too. So he had a friend, I think this kid's name was Alex. So he came in and they recorded for, those two tracks. I believe it was Cultural Faux Pas and certainly Galactic Cattle Hand. And that gave the band this really different sound that we kind of thought, we should kind of run with this. Right.
Hmm.
Andy was committed to it. I mean, he wanted to kind of get into a different type of project too and do something a little more original. And Alex was, it literally was just to come in and do a session, a couple of tracks. And I think there's a gig in there that he might have done.
Mm.
But we were looking for somebody that was a little more committed to the project. And again, I think we just ran an ad, you know, good old Town Magazine. And Bob responded to Bob McAvoy. And, Bob came in and just brought it. He was the trumpet player, but he brought in this ton of energy and enthusiasm and creativity. You know, he was a real spark plug in the band, even live. And he was much more than just the trumpet player in the band, right?
Right.
So he was a character, and he would do some, you know, some sort of rap stuff, and he'd write lyrics so that was the band for myself, Carlos Rubin, Andy Wise, and Bob McAvoy on trumpet. And so that was the Heroic Doses lineup.
Now I kind of skipped over this a little bit. Now I'm not a musician, however I've heard that the bass and drums have a unique relationship together in a band. So I'm curious,
yes.
How is it now playing with Alonzo, who had the Chapman stick? Was there any kind of adjustment to be made on your part? I mean, it seems like it's a unique instrument that not a lot of rock bands had.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I loved it. I mean, again, that was one of the another little thing that made me go, yeah, I want to play in this band. Because when I got there, there was a bass guitar there, but he was playing a Chapman stick. And again, so I'm like, wow, shit, okay, love it. You know, let's see where this goes. So, I didn't really, if anything, it allowed me to kind of create more kind of rhythmic things to stretch it out a little bit more, because that's kind of what Carlos was doing too. We weren't that, certainly weren't that, you know, locked in, bass drum, you know, we weren't the James Brown rhythm section by any means, you know what I mean? We were definitely more, sort of a prog rhythm section, if you will. I thought it was amazing to work with just the different stuff that he would come up, the textures and stuff he would come up with on the Chapman stick would inspire me to kind of, oh, what about this? Like, there were times where Carlos and I would spend hours just like playing around with kind of, you know, linear rhythms on the drums And, you know, he would be, again, exploring the instrument. It was a new instrument for him, right? So, you know, I think when he picked up the bass for the first time, it was just like, sounded like Geddy Lee. I think it was a Ricky, too. So it was like, let's stick with the stick thing. Yeah, it was a great sound. It was a pretty unique sound, and that also I think made me kind of explore more textures in my drum set. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to kind of toss out a lot of the conventional stuff and just create this sort of wacky, you know, boneyard, scrapyard kind of drum set, and that's what you hear on the Heroic Doses album.
We'll talk a lot about Heroic Doses in just a minute, but more on the Park Alien era. How was the EP recorded, funded?
Okay, so Park Alien, I think it was self-funded, and I think the only one with a steady job at the time was Ruben, so he probably, you know, ponied up, you know, most of the cash to get the record recorded. But again, it was just a four-song EP. It was, we went in, I think we were pretty prepared when we went in. So it wasn't like go in the studio and start writing.
Right.
So we just were recording the tracks. It was a late at night thing. So it was probably, you know, a couple of days. Again, it's 30 years ago. I don't remember. It's, I can't believe it's been that long. You know, it's shocking when I actually think about it. And that people are even still, you know, this small amount of people that we had that were actually into the band now, you know, still, you know, kind of, we have an Instagram page and a Facebook thing and that we put up fairly recently. And, you know, people still coming on and, you know, adding little things. And oh, I saw you guys here. I saw you guys that killer show. And, you know, it's amazing that people still remember, you know, because we were a small little piece of blip in time, you know, so. But yeah, so we got the Park Alien record recorded, and then I think we got a bit of a break when we, for some reason, got onto an I Mother Earth gig at the, I think it was the Opera House.
Oh wow!
And we were the first of three bands, and I Mother Earth was, you know, they were starting to, you know, they were kind of like a name band at the time, they had, I think, just signed their big U.S. record deal, and they were kind of warm-up gigs, right? And we must have had an agent at the time. so I think it was this guy named Paul Strathy who just kind of liked the sound of the band and took us on, and anyway, threw us on this I Mother Earth gig. And the band were sort of immediate fans of ours, you know, because they were... You know, they were a great band, and they were great players, and they were pushing sort of more of that. Jag was a pretty phenomenal guitar player, and Bruce is a great, you know, they're all great musicians. So they kind of looked at us and thought, ah, these guys are, you know, cool. They can play, and they're doing this really, you know, got this wacky thing. They do a King Crimson cover, so they called their manager, a guy by the name of Bob Latella. And he came down and saw us and kind of wanted, you know, I'll manage you guys. So that kind of led to the next, you know, project to get Doses done. So we did a few shows. I guess we did a bunch of shows probably, but just local stuff. I don't think we actually got out and did any really significant touring and national touring until Doses.
Interesting. So I guess you could say that the Park Alien EP really set the stage for what would come with Heroic Doses.
Well, actually, I think it's great. I mean, I like Galactic Cattlehand was sort of one of our live staples that people that came out to see us, they had to hear that one, right? So there's some, I think, some really great ideas on that. And Fraz, there's a song called Fraz, which is still one of my favorites of any of them that we recorded. And it's from that EP. I really thought, it's kind of, you know, it's this wacky kind of tune, but I thought that we really nailed the playing, I think, is great on it. And it had some really interesting textures and but it got us sort of out there, and you know, we could go out and start doing some gigs, and then people started, you know, noticing us. And then when you get guys in bigger bands that are like, we want these guys to come on tour with us, then that's, you know, that's where it starts, right?
Amazing. So,
yeah. It was I Mother Earth that kind of got us going.
Now, as a fan, I mean, you mentioned, you know, like early to mid 90s there, the scene in Canada, especially around Toronto in that area. Do you remember as a fan going to gigs and going down Queen Street and seeing this scene kind of develop that would become the 90s Canadian alternative music scene?
Absolutely. Loved it. I mean, that's, you know, if I wasn't sitting at home, you know, doing paradiddles, we were out at, you know, going out to see, you know, Lee's Palace or Sneaky D's or whatever, just hanging out, checking out bands, just being part of the, you know, part of the whole scene. And yeah, it was a really, really exciting time. It's a really fun time.
So going into the writing for Doses, At what point do you guys then say we're going to bring in Bob and Andy as full-time members of the band? At what point in the writing process do you figure that part out?
Right away.
Yeah.
I think going into, when Bob came on board, it was, okay, this is the sound of the band.
Hmm.
And it got us, it got us some attention. If there were any write-ups or, you had somebody coming out from Chart Magazine or Exclaim or anything, mm-hmm. they would always, you got to comment on the horn section, right? we would get the Rage Against the Machine with a horn section or Faith No More with a horn section.
Right.
That was always sort of brought into it. And the guy on the Chapman stick,
Yeah.
So, that just became the sound of the band. That was as important to the sound as the guitar was, or the drums, or the stick was.
Now with, horn section, which is different already, and then now you add, before that you had dual vocalists going, which is another different element from a lot of bands. Is that difficult or easier as a band to get gigs, saying that, okay, they're different because they've got this, this, and this, or they're not going to fit because they have this, this, and this?
Yeah, I think that it worked for us, and it also worked against us because, again, it did get mentioned quite often that, oh, yeah, this guy saw this band, and he got the horn section, it was really cool. But we went and did, there was a 97.7 Hits Radio, I guess, had a Battle of the Bands contest.
Mm.
And this was pretty early on, I think. I don't even know if we had released. Yeah, we did. Doses had just come out.
Hmm.
And so we went, we said, let's do it. So we went down there and it had this panel of judges. Tim Mitchell was one, I think. And
oh, nice.
Steve Anthony from Much Music. A couple people you knew, and somebody from Hits. Anyway, so there's, half a dozen bands or whatever. And anyway, we won the thing.
Oh, nice.
And the prize was you get to have, they'll play your single on 97.7, right? So they'll put you in the rotation, which was great. But they never played our, they wouldn't put Heroic Doses on because they have some policy of they don't play horn bands.
Wow.
Which was just ridiculous. I mean, when on the face of it, when you think, we just won your freaking contest.
Yeah.
The prize is, we're going to feature your single. We're going to add you to our rotation. And then, I guess somebody looked at the fine print and said, oh, wait, we don't play horn bands. Which, what does that even mean?
Like, exactly.
They don't play Chicago and they don't, no kidding, they don't. It was like a 90s fucking grunge alternative station. There are no other horn bands.
Yeah.
So that's a case certainly where it didn't work for us. I think that for some people, they just thought the band was, we didn't get it really embraced by radio because of the sound. It was too weird. Mm. We even had, we had done the Pistons album, I remember bumping into, Dean Cameron, God rest his soul. He was the president at EMI, and he signed us, to a deal. And, at the time they had a bunch of good bands that were, they had the Eye of the Earth, they had a Conline Crush and Moist, Tom Cochran. They were all releasing records at the same time. And it was sort of like whoever got the most radio ads kind of got, more juice from EMI. And, unfortunately we weren't getting it because I think for us, we weren't an immediate thing. It wasn't like, oh yeah, I get that. It was like, well, that was interesting, but it's kind of weird. So we weren't that, add this right now. So we did, kind of had limited radio exposure. But I remember bumping into Dean Cameron, a year after we released that record. And he said, I know we didn't get the radio we wanted and the record didn't happen. But he said, man, that is one of my favorite records that I've ever had the pleasure of working with or on. And he said, it's been in my my car CD player for the last year. I play it all the time. And he was like, I'm sorry, we couldn't break you guys. But it's just, it's just that resistance from, these radio guys and, wherever, Winnipeg and Saskatoon. And, it's just like, these guys sound too weird. you know. So, you know, one time we had even discussed, our manager, Bob, said, you know, you guys should just, you know, pack up your shit and move to New York, move to New York City, and just do, you know, just do the ground, work your way up, you know. You know, of course we never did, and maybe if we did. But now, I mean, with the internet and all of these different ways of getting your music and your band out there, I think it would have been certainly a different experience for us if we had access to that, because I think we did have a pretty unique sound. And for those that did kind of do a deeper dive into the music, they really enjoyed what we were doing. It's just, we couldn't get that out to a larger group of people at the time. It was back then, if you needed a record deal and you needed radio and you needed much music, you needed video, you needed, you know, MTV, and those things, some of them don't even exist anymore.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, you can DIY all this stuff now. Bands that, you know, don't even have record deals that are doing really well. So, it was a struggle, because although we kind of knew what we were doing and we were really, you know, we knew we had something really cool and something that was a little, you know, I bumped into, again, I'm not just name dropping here, but I bumped into Ralph James and Ray Maida from Our Lady Peace.
Nice.
At this event. You know, Ralph didn't recognize me. I was like, yeah, it's Christian, I used to play in Glue Leg. You know, booked some gigs for us and stuff. He's like, oh, fuck yeah. He goes, yeah, man. He goes, you know what? You guys were way ahead of your time. and Rain said the same thing.
Yeah, awesome.
So yeah, you were. You're just ahead of your time. Like, your sound almost sounds more like now, you know? So I took that as a compliment.
Absolutely. It's...
It was a shame that we just didn't get the exposure that we felt one we deserved. But I mean, that's a great lament of every band, you know, other than the few that actually get to the top. It's, you know, it's exposure and getting somebody to listen to your music. You know? So that's the thing. That's the challenge.
Yeah, indeed.
Creating it, and then it's getting people to actually listen to it. Yeah. And then you got to get out and tour. And we seem to be constantly, you know, we had agents that were working us, and Much Music helped us out a lot, because we did get, I don't know if we were heavy rotation, as they, I think they called it, but we were certainly medium rotation, a couple of our tracks. And so that really helped. So it enabled us to kind of tour. And we also benefited from having, again, friends in bands that were much bigger than we were that would want to take us out on tour. Mm. Our Lady Peace were breaking big time. And I mean, everybody wanted to open up for them.
Yeah. Right?
And so they took us out across the country, I think maybe once, maybe twice. I can't remember. The Tea Party was another one that, you know, kind of said, we want, like, it wasn't like we're being pushed on them. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe that they kind of said, no, we want them to come out with us because we like what they're doing. Certainly I, Mother Earth, were huge supporters of ours. And it's funny, I ended up actually playing drums in for Edwin when we dissolved.
Oh, did you? Because I know Ruben was involved with his solo record.
Yeah. I came along for the ride.
Did you record the whole album as well with Edwin?
No, I was only on a couple of tracks. Most of it was recorded by the time, the drums were recorded by the time I even got there. So I did, you know, all of the touring for the first year or two.
Which two tracks were you on the Edwin record?
A song called Theories. Take Me Anywhere was actually a Glue Leg song. So Ruben had written a bunch of songs that we were going to use on the next Glue Leg record that ended up on Ed's record.
Huh.
Two or three anyway.
That's interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah. I was actually mentioned Bob Latella was pushed for this for, you know, like 5 minutes, but before Ed decided he was going to go solo, and he left the Mothers, and we were, so Bob was like, why don't you front glue leg, and you can call it something else, but glue leg could be your backup band. And we had these really cool tunes, and like Ruben had put together some really kind of, it was a really wacky sound. I think it would have been brilliant for glue leg. We've got some of the tracks, but they're not released. But it was, it's hard to describe, sort of wacky kind of spy music almost, you know. Ed did use it, but it got, you know, a different producer came in and, you know, obviously with Ed singing, it's a different animal altogether at the end of it. But, yeah.
Hmm.
So some of the stuff that was going to be on, the next Glue Leg album ended up on Ed's record.
Interesting. That's fascinating to me. That blew my mind, sir. dial back a bit, I was watching an old interview. You guys mentioned, you mentioned Much Music just a little while ago, and it was an old interview you guys on Much. And Diego, the VJ, had mentioned something called Smoke the Pen.
Yeah.
What was that exactly? And it sounded like an interesting thing that I had never heard another band doing before.
Okay, that definitely came from Bob's beautiful, magnificent brain. he had a lot of really great ideas. And Smoke the Pen, this is the first time I've heard of it since then. Like, I'm trying to think now, what the fuck was that? Now I think it was pass around a notepad and a pen and to the audience, and just people would write shit down, and then it would come back to the stage. Huh. And then I guess Bob would read it out or rhyme it out. Or that's my recollection of it. I don't think it was around that long, but I think that was the idea.
With Heroic Doses, though, I can't get away from that record without asking about Mr. Pink. Now, did the idea for a song in tribute to him come first, or did the music come first and then the lyrics?
We had all just seen Reservoir Dogs, obviously. It was right around that time, mm-hmm. and loved the movie. And I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was Bob that wrote all the lyrics for that. Certainly most of them, if not all of them. But the rhythm, that song kind of had a really, you know, cool sort of beat. I remember that. I found a cassette, and there's about 45 minutes of that rhythm being played.
Oh, wow.
With Carlos and I, just the two of us. And you could tell, you know, it got better as the cassette got more and more into it. Obviously we were just sort of working it and locking in on that. And, so that just came from, you know, I was almost doing an exercise, but I had kind of a unique setup again on the drums. Like, I had removed my hi-hats, and I was using these rings from, I don't know if you know what a rototom is, but they have these interior rings that, so you could just twist them and the tension would go up. So it would go. So anyway, I removed the skin, the top part, and I just took the interior rings and bored out a hole and used those for my hi-hat. So they had this sort of clang, 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 clang. So I was just playing with that, and my ride at the time was a big piece of sheet metal, and I had some, you know, pipes and metal pipes and stuff. So just working out this pattern just for fun. And then Carlos starts to lay this stuff over top of it on the stick. And, you know, and you can even hear us on the second. Well, that's pretty fucking cool. Let's keep going on that. So, yeah, you know, about 45 minutes later, the tape stops, and that was the end of it. But, that's how that song came together. It was basically just this kind of rhythm and then this groove that, you know, Carlos putting stuff on it, and it sounded really cool. And then, you know, Ruben would put his big, you know, slave guitars on it. And Bob's had the lyrics, and have you seen the video for that?
I just watched it today. I rewatched it for the first time in a long time.
what did you think of that? I just saw it too recently, and that is an LSD trip. I don't know if I've ever seen anything that had more edits. So it was like Mr. Brainwash. Wasn't that guy's name from Exit Through the Gift Shop? You remember that, Mr.?
Yeah.
I think it was Mr. Brainwash. It was just like, I watched it and I was like, okay, I think I'm going to have a stroke right now.
You have literal dogs playing poker. I mean, literally dogs play poker, like a painting come to life. Man.
And I remember I had we were drinking. Certainly I was. I remember just, I was like shit-faced. And I think they wanted me to smoke a cigarette in one of the scenes I was in. And I did smoke back then, but not like this. I mean, it was literally like always, you know, kind of for hours with a cigarette and, you know, pounding beers. And, you know, it's a rough morning, as I imagine. But again, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. I mean, it was just a really trippy shoot. And then when I saw the video, because I think somebody posted it not that long ago, and I watched it, and I was just like, okay, that's insane.
Do you know whose mind that video idea germinated from? Or was that the director? Or was that one of the people in the band?
No,
or?
I do remember, though, somebody going, you know, hey, I know this person that's got all these trained dogs. And they'll be playing poker like, you know, like gangsters. And they'll be the reservoir dogs. You know, and at that time, I was like, yeah.
Yeah, right on. Yeah.
Sure, that sounds amazing. You know, it's funny because when you look back, you know, now, you know, decades later, mm-hmm. and you know, since the band, I started my own business, and you know, I have a partner, but you know, things have gone well. We've done well, but I've, you know, really had to kind of put on a completely different hat and you know, become this sort of different person that was so alien to what I was back then. But looking back at those days and what, you know, sort of what I know now more about just sort of business and the whole, you know, dealing with agents, dealing with managers, dealing with video treatments, dealing with directors, dealing with, yeah, it would be, you know, back then it was just like, go along with everything, just say yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you know, hey, we're shooting video here, and just be there.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And that was it. And I was for everything, agents and managers. It was just like, we don't. And I think that's the, you know, the curse for a lot of bands too, is that you just sort of go along with it, and you get, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of bands that, after Ed, I ended up playing with Saga for a couple of years, and, you know, they had some pretty rough stories with, you know, managers and crooked people that were, you know, those guys actually made some money, right? But so they got, you know, they had a, you know, some crooks in their organization that, you know, so again, you're just kind of dumb and you just go along with whatever, because, you know, you don't feel, you can almost step up and go, hey, wait a minute, that doesn't sound, you know, we're not doing that. It's just like, you just go with it, right? Yeah. We're the musicians. We just, that's our job. That's all we do is, you know, but.
Yeah, I mean, especially early on, you're afraid to say no to things, you know, yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. Certainly when the record companies are sniffing around and they, you know, they want to sign you to a deal, you know, and again, we're not coming in with a lot of, you know, we're just sort of scraping by hoping to, you know, somebody will pick us up. So if you get any interest, you know, it's not like there was a bidding war on Glue Light, you know, so we just kind of were like, yep, where do I sign? Like most bands.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you,
yeah. And then the horror stories come out later.
But just to put the button on Mr. Pink, anybody ever hear anything from Tarantino or anybody involved with the film?
I don't believe so. And that's something I would remember. I think we were kind of hoping for that, but, you know, of course. Well, of course, Quentin Tarantino is going to hear it and he's going to love it.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to want to direct the video.
Your name. The game seems simple. And-
mentioned like labels and stuff, you know, starting to get interested in the band. I mean, that was right before Heroic Doses. I mean, was it Liquid and Page Productions, I think?
Yeah, Liquid Records was something that was put together by Bob Littell, our manager. You know, I think he wanted to kind of get a piece of the record too. You know, again, it's such a different time to today. So we did have, you know, I remember we had done a few gigs, and I remember one where we played with a head. It's like a Barry thing. Anyway, there was a couple of guys from EMI, I think, that had came up, had come up to see us. So it was, you know, it's like, oh, there's a couple of record guys in the audience. And they eventually signed us, but it was sort of this weird kind of co-deal with Liquid because, you know, Bob wanted to, I guess, get this label up to, you know, to turn it into something. Again, it's one of those, if we could have gone back, that is something that I probably, you know, with, you know, today's eyes, I would have said, eh, no. Let's just sign directly with EMI. But Page was... there's a guy in the States that really liked, I know he really liked the record. He was a fan, this older guy, rich guy, that we went down to South by Southwest and we played. He came out, I think he was from down there somewhere, and, you know, this guy, just well tanned, you know, lots of bling on and stuff. You know, he looked like he had some money, and so we were kind of like, oh, this is, you know, cool. But, and he was just kind of getting going, and so yeah, I mean, that Page record, I think it was Page, I don't think it went anywhere. It was right around that time as well. We got a call from Roadrunner.
Oh, really?
Who was interested? Yeah, they were interested in the band, and they had, I guess they had just signed Nickelback, and what was that band that was their big hit, one of their first terrible band, Creed, or yeah, I think it was Creed. Yeah, so they were kind of about that and those kind of bands, but I think there were a couple of interesting bands on their roster. Bob did say to me, again, Bob, our manager, said years later, he said, you know, I kind of think, you know, in hindsight, we should have probably taken that Roadrunner deal. I think it was a pretty shitty deal, but who knows, right?
Right, yeah.
It's hindsight, right? It's absolutely. You know, we could all go back and change this, that, and the other thing.
And another couple of tracks that were, you know, people still mention in some of the posts and stuff I see online with, of course, Come With Me, which was one of the singles off the record, and the title track.
Yeah.
Any kind of memories about writing and recording those two songs?
Yeah, Ruben came in with Heroic Doses, the riff, and the lyrics. So yeah, and that was one of those, like, yeah, okay, that's cool, there's definitely, you know, something there. And I think that we really locked in on the performance on that. I think the performance on that is pretty solid. Come With Me, not so much. Like, I'm certainly not happy with what I played on. I mean, listen, now it's just kind of all over the place. Like, the groove is almost non-existent from the drums. But yeah, you know, there's a vibe there. It's really weird because I used to never be able to listen to any of it. For about 10 years. I mean, I would put it on and I would just like immediately like just zone in on all the mistakes.
Right.
And and then after, you know, I don't know, but I hadn't heard it for about 10 years and put it on. I loved it. It was like I was listening with just like completely different ears. I was like, I wasn't listening just for what I was doing. I just take the whole thing in, and you know, headphones on, lights off, and you know, turned up nice and loud. And yeah, I loved it. It sounded great. That's the same with our other record too, our Clodhopper record too. Hated it. Didn't want to listen to it ever.
Really?
And then, of course, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, it's more of just a personal sort of insecurity thing. You know, I kind of beat myself up no matter how well I played.
Right, yeah.
I would just be, oh, I could have done better, and I wish I had, you know. There's a lot of There's a lot of doses, a lot on doses. There's a lot of ideas on there. It's a pretty dense album. It's jam packed, and there were a lot of chiefs in the band. You know, so that kind of led to, you know, the eventual breakup, but the turmoil in the band, because there was a lot of, you know, we were pretty, pretty fiery guys. A lot of volatility in the band, and who was kind of getting their songs on the record, or you know, so yeah, it got pretty ugly.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that. Just having two kind of front men as it was, and then having two kind of main songwriters or multiple songwriters, lyricists. Is that kind of what led to Carlos's departure from after Heroic Doses?
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask this.
Had to. Sorry, man.
But yeah, no, of course. No, I mean, it's a big part of the band's history. Right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yes, Carlos was, I loved his like, just an eccentric guy, really creative guy, but really, you know, he had a real edge, you know, could be a pretty angry guy back then. A lot of fun to hang around, really charismatic, all that stuff. But then there was this other side that, you know, so yeah, I know that we were in pre-production for Clodhopper, and it had been brewing for some time. You know, this sort of animosity, and for mostly between Ruben and Carlos, there was a lot of tension. And myself in there too. I mean, I was a pretty angry guy too, pretty fiery guy too. But we were in the middle of rehearsal, and you know, something was said back, and next thing you know, the guitars were thrown on the ground, and there was like, those two were just going at it, just blows.
Wow.
Yeah. And Carlos, you know, got up off the ground and kind of grabbed his stick and walked out the door and grabbed the keys to the glue bus, which was our mode of transportation back then. It was like a converted school bus that we had, a mini one. And he just sort of gunned it and tore off.
Wow.
And that was the last I'd seen from him in 20 years.
Wow.
Like he was just gone. So no contact, you know, at all. He went on and just had a totally different, you know, life. We're just sort of kind of back together now fairly recently. So we're kind of catching up on that. You know, it was like 2 decades there that we sort of missed what each of us has been doing and done in that time. Anyway, so we've got record company interest. You know, they've been coming out and seeing us, and we're putting together songs for the new record, and one of our main guys, it just leaves. He's gone.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, fuck you guys, I'm out of here, you know, and you know, I guess you kind of think, oh, he'll be back, you know. But,
yeah.
No, it was final.
Crazy.
And so we're thinking, okay, shit, what are we going to do now? Where are we going to find another Chapman stick player? You know?
Yeah.
The other thing too was the character, right? That Carlos brought, because he was a very intense guy, but on stage too, intense performer, and that's, you know, kind of what you want, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so and. He played this unique instrument, and he also sang, and he big shoes to fill, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so we're kind of like, oh, wow, everything's kind of starting to happen now. And probably had a big tour in the offing, and so we're like, shit, what are we going to do? So back to Now Magazine.
How much of Clodhopper was then written with Alonzo? I mean, because the liner notes just say music by Glue Leg. There's no specific credits. And I know that you guys played Pistons before on Much Music, before Clodhopper was even released, with Alonzo doing, you know, vocals and playing in that.
I had completely forgotten about that. Somebody found it and posted it on YouTube, and I was just, holy shit, I had no idea that was out there. I don't even remember doing that. and then I realized, oh, okay, so Carlos was in the band when Pistons was written, which was another one of our singles, right? One of our songs. It was the main track off of Clodhopper would be Pistons, I would think.
Absolutely. I mean, that's my favorite jam, hands down, of the post-Alonzo era of Glue Leg.
Yeah, I love it. It's so intense. I love that song, too.
But just to finish that earlier question, how much of Clodhopper was written before Carlos's departure?
Don't know. I don't think there was much written. Mm. I think that's when, Ruben really kind of took over. Everybody got kind of writing credit because I think just of the nature of the band, because again, it wasn't just like we were, we had a singer songwriter guy and we were the support band. I mean, mm-hmm. it was a unique group of people that were all bringing something to the sound. But Ruben wrote most of the stuff. We'd all sort of pitch in ideas, chime in, oh, what about this? How about this? Even things like with Mr. Pink, there were things that started off with, me playing a little rhythm on the drums, and then it's like, oh, okay. And then the bass would come in doing something, and then the guitar riff would come over top of that. And then it's okay, yeah, this is cool. Let's try, try this. And, then all of a sudden the chorus appears, and then lyrics are being written. And, well, how did that song get written?
Right,
it wasn't like somebody came in and said, okay, here's your charts. This is the new song we're going to be playing, right? So it was like a grassroots sort of, a lot of people contributed. But I do remember Ruben coming in with a demo of Pistons. It was a drum machine, and it was almost all there.
Huh.
In the demo, and I wish I had that demo because we were excited. He goes, I think I got the new single off the next album. I listened to it, and I was just like, I think you did too. That's fucking sick. That is so good. And so that was an exciting moment.
We'll be right back.
When Alonzo leaves, I mean, he was, he started the band with Ruben way back when. And, you know, how does some of the legalities work as far as like who owns the name or, publishing or performance royalties or, is that stuff that you said he just walked away? But I mean, is that stuff that they have to sort out behind the scenes? I mean, is there lawyers involved and stuff like that? Or?
No, nobody owns the name. And the songwriting, publishing has all been sort of, so Carlos gets a share in publishing on Heroic Doses, Park Alien, Angst, which I don't get, but I mean, come on, it's a pittance. No one's made any money, off of this stuff. But that's sort of the breakdown was, with Clodhopper Record, it's, and Chowder's part of that publishing on that, that record. So there's no, nobody had that. I owned the Blue Leg name.
Yeah, you just hear horror stories from other bands.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the Guess Who, I don't know if you know that story. But
no,
that,
I don't.
That was apparently like the bass player bought it for $1 back in, this is what I was told.
Huh.
Burton Cummings was off of doing a solo thing. He's like, I'll never be in the Guess Who again. Fine, here. Signed off on it. Bass player bought the name. And so when they did the reunion tour, I mean, the bass player wasn't even in the band touring, but he was getting paid because they were using the name. And I guess they got tired of having to cut him a check and then just changed it to Bachman Cummings or whatever.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or they called it. Seen the Pink Floyd war and, all that. Names can get pretty messy. Guns N' Roses,
yeah.
Sort of thing. These are big, huge bands.
One more lineup change, though, before we get deep into Clodhopper, was Bob leaves the band as well. I mean, was that before Carlos or after, or what was kind of the circumstances around his departure?
That was before Carlos. Mm. Yeah. That made me very sad because Bob and I were very close. He was a great guy, really interesting guy, smart guy, funny guy, but didn't like the road. I didn't either, but I didn't know what else I was going to do. I just think Bob had more options, I stuck it out, but he just, hated it and loved performing. Like, I don't think anybody loved performing more than he did. It was just the, all the other stuff.
Yeah, especially touring Canada with those long drives between cities and towns.
Seven guys in a van.
Yeah.
All that stuff. And sleeping in, on floors and, sharing beds. And meals when you got to the venue,
Yeah.
Our per diem was a joke. I mean, they'd buy you cigarettes.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Raven's Rule. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, you can do so in a variety of ways. First, you can go to patreon.com/ravedrool, become a patron, get access to deleted audio, get advance notice of the guests, and get a chance to submit questions to those guests for an exclusive Patreon Q&A. Visit redbubble.com, search Rave Drool, and you can buy various goods with the Raven Drool podcast logo on it. Follow or subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to this. And if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star rating and review. If you're looking for more 90s Karen Rock content, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Until next time, friends, take care. Again.